Day. I'm pleased to have the next speaker, Professor Alison Liebling. She talks from a prisoner's perspective, not, of course, she on prisoners.
Thank you very much. I already hope we do this again, largely because it's so nice to see so many different bits of our criminological enterprise reflected in one room. It's not often we see people from all our different courses and all the different bits of criminology that we teach in one place. And my reflections today have actually been precipitated by three things. Conversations held with prisoners in Whitemoor about their lives outside. These conversations were held before the events of the summer, but they're relevant, I think. Some correspondence following the riot, so two prisoners from our research in Whitemoor spontaneously wrote letters containing an analysis of the riots based on discussions we'd held in the prison. And then thirdly, a visit to Franklin Prison in February of this year, during which I was shown a very moving painting. The painting was a response to the riots by a prisoner. And I asked if I could have it photographed to show it here. I thought it would stimulate discussion. I haven't been allowed, I'll explain. I've had to try and remember why the painting moved me, and it portrayed, I thought, or communicated sadness. It portrayed burning streets and conflict, and then a sort of ending of something to do with the country, a kind of vision of maybe a British way of life, no longer plausible, and in any case, out of reach. So after lengthy correspondence about the painting, involving some clarification I had to provide that there'd be no press present today, I was told that it was too sensitive. Not the content, but the form. So not what it portrayed, but the fact that it was art. Okay? So art is risky. It's regarded as indulgent and permissive beyond public acceptability. It can go on in prison, but undercover. And this pointless censorship is noted and understood by prisoners. So in some frustration, I want to talk briefly about prisoners as observers and consumers of political action, paraphrasing what seems to be their political theory of the riots, which I shall call a theory of distributive injustice. And I'm drawing in particular on one meeting of a regular, what we called Cambridge Dialogue Group, held with a regular group of prisoners organised by us, the research team, over about 10 weeks, and this was as part of our re-entry into Whitemoor. One of the striking changes we observed as we re-entered the prison to formally repeat a research project on staff-prisoner relationships, which we'd conducted just over 10 years earlier, was that the prisoners were younger, they were more likely to be black and mixed-race backgrounds, and they seemed to be full of bullet holes. And this was noticeable because they wanted us to see them. They pointed them out, lifting up their trouser legs or T-shirt to show us their wounds. Or, more often, they observed as we walked along Whitemoor's long, cold corridors together on a January afternoon that it was painful to feel a cold wind in your forehead. Any of you who've walked along these long corridors will know what they mean. But when you had a hole in your forehead. And this phenomenon had not been a feature of our first project. So another significant difference was that we had to invent our own dialogue group, the one that had existed in the first project, which we'd joined and become regular members of, had been stopped. The outside facilitators had displayed riskiness, so we offered to organise one instead, an offer the prison received warmly because it added to their purposeful activity hours and got some difficult-to-place prisoners doing something countable. So it was not easy at all to organise this group, I have to say, but we managed and found ourselves getting to know a regular group of very articulate, insightful, funny and engaging men over quite a long period of time. So we felt like Cohen and Taylor, those of you who know psychological survival, with some important differences. We were three, not two, and we were all female, and we didn't hate staff. If you've read Psychological Survival, you'll know that Cohen and Taylor hated staff. The prisoners challenged us. In addition to their legitimate fears and cynicism about research, they were capable of a fair amount of othering. So they thought our lives were perfect. They thought we were middle class. They said we'd never known trouble. And if we had, for example, all three of us came from broken homes and had survived the experience, then we'd receive the kind of emotional support that middle class people always get when their lives are in trouble. So they thought we were not materially or emotionally deprived in the way that they could so powerfully describe. And we had to talk all this out. And once we had, they were satisfied with our acknowledgement that this project may not help them very much, but they still wanted to participate. Once they decided that we were going ahead, they brought the chairs of our group closer together in a symbolic act of assent. They wanted to be heard, have a voice, and felt we might be able to help them self-educate. We were their privileged guests, and they could certainly educate us. They became our first interviewees for the project once we moved into the interview stage. So, for their part, they asserted pride and honour in what they described as their alpha male masculinity. Guns made even small men big, and success, they said, was a kind of weak compliance with the rules and habits of others and hypocrites. But I'll come back to this. There were two parallel worlds with an impermeable membrane between them. And this has been described beautifully in a recent article in the New Review on East Baltimore in America, where on one side of the membrane, crime is the only viable choice. So they wanted to describe their lives outside. This was also new, and a striking difference between the first project and the second. In the first, there was much more emphasis given to the prison experience as a topic in its own right. This time, 12 years later, it was hard to separate life inside from the context in which the sentence arose, as well as the new length and often indeterminate nature of the sentence being served. They wanted to talk about school, teachers, guns, danger, fear, women, and the street. So we set out an agenda for the weeks to follow and gave them articles to read to stimulate discussion. So week two, the first substantive topic, was life outside. And they read this Holdsworth and Silverstone, That's Life in It, A British Perspective on Guns, Crime and Social Order. So here are some observations about school. It provides the framework for the first social exclusion. If your parents can't provide you with proper nutrition, you can't concentrate. Proper equipment, you can't take part. Proper clothes, you're marked as an outsider. Your parents don't know what to do. They're people from the working class. School is a middle class institution. You're excluded from the start. You don't have the right mentality. You're from the wrong part of town. You get bullied. Teachers don't understand you because they're not from the ends. They don't know what you're talking about. So they experienced school teachers and authority as distant figures from another land. They say we're in gangs. They write our lives. They actually understood very little. Almost every male relative they had was in trouble, in prison, or involved in dangerous transactions. And you get targeted. That's his brother, so he deserves to be fought. They talked about going to prison as being a mark of honour when you're young, and how you end up living in the present, and about the confusing moral messages they got from their own caregivers. So describing, for example, their mother saying, don't tell the social worker you live here, that's going to get us into trouble, we haven't paid the rent. So it was when you got a longer sentence you thought, wait a minute, this isn't funny. They told us, you think you're going to make a million and then go straight. And materialism, they said, takes the edge off suffering, but you always want more. It gets ugly and it doesn't help. So they saw authority as hypocritical. I wanted you to look at the example on war, that they were saying war is a bad example for the power of the gun. It's hypocritical. Pictures of war in the media are teaching us to do the same thing. They want to tell you to follow the rules, but in fact they bend the rules. It's kind of justification for gun crime. If they can do it, we can do it. Politicians are breaking the rules, it becomes normal. So society's a big lie. Everybody cheats to get what he wants. They thought women did play a role in these dynamics. They argued women wanted their men to have power and status. You get respect for those things, and you get respect when you come out of prison. So we're forced to prove ourselves, they said. One of the dialogue group members said, stay away from them honey trap girls, as he called them. So they got some of the blame. These conversations were emotionally and intellectually engaging and highly energetic. several of our prisoner group were budding Open University students, and they were torn between business studies and sociology because they found their readings on the Risk Society made sense of their own condition. They were other and dangerous, and they recognised themselves in the critical literature, not as victims, but as sort of duped wannabe rich kids. And they said things like, "I had the wrong ideology, it was dysfunctional. You have aspiration, and then capitalism kicks in. You make a grand and you think, I can do anything with it. It's all materialistic, it's all about social mobility. You want it, you can't have it." So they were criticising capitalist values, values their commentators and condemners believe them to share, and they talked often and throughout the project about their search for meaning, family, brotherhood, and for a firmer identity. So they said things like this: "That article makes sense. The relation to capitalism makes sense. A society based less on capitalism would provide the opportunity to live a different life in the future. And talking about religion giving you better values and showing you a way." It's significant religious conversion is becoming a powerful phenomenon in the lives of the excluded, both in and out of prison. So there's neutralisation and resistance here, but also moral critique. That they mentioned the war in Iraq, the MP's expenses scandal, the lack of morality in government, suggests to me that a form of unchanneled or unharnessed participation in social and moral argument could be exploited, and why not via art, further education and dialogue? How can we be so, whatever it is, resentful or afraid as to believe that these activities are indulgences? So their theory of the riots. These prisoners seem to speak as excluded, doubting consumers. Their descriptions of life on the streets communicate material and emotional deprivation, exclusion and resentment. This has come up in some of the comments we've heard already. They said things like, "Asians have family businesses. It's all right for them." They were almost poetic on the significance of territory, the presence of guns, and the experience of chaos in their lives. They exist on the edge of the economy, but express a magnetic attraction to materialism, short-termism, and moral confusion. So your mother tells you to lie to the council, or we'll be behind on our rent. The police are not trusted, they lie and fit you up. They describe what feels like harassment on the basis of postcode and peers. So you end up living in the present, and material wealth takes the edge off, but then the buzz wears off. So they're critics of materialism, they're also its victims, but like a drug, it beckons. I did notice the resonances with what Ben's been reading. So their accounts are recognisable, drawing on a mixture of structural deprivation, strain theory, drift, defiance, and legal cynicism. So here's one paper on the riots that suggests all of these things are playing a part. I think what the prisoners' observations add, in my view, is the beginning of a political theory of their condition, a sort of distributive injustice theory. But further othering, moral condemnation, and the rush to punishment will just confirm their working hypothesis about how social and criminal justice operates, mainly against them. So my response to the official discourse on the summer riots was disappointed too, at the sentencing hysteria, the lack of intelligent analysis, and the ideological rhetoric we heard, a broken society and a broken penal system, condemning both the perpetrators and the penal system as flawed agents. Some of the behaviour was instrumental and some was expressive. And if we look further afield, as well as back in time, we can accept, I think, that a riot is a kind of moral argument with the state. And if that's the case, I think we should be discussing the nature and meaning of that moral argument. Pearson's powerful article in The Independent on East Baltimore makes the case that there are two Americas, politically and economically distinct, and those with opportunities don't qualify to act as peers in judgment over those without. I think it's an interesting thought when we think about what went on in the courts over summer. Thank you.
Thank you, Alison, for a further, very interesting perspective.